Chapter 41. It wasn't until Bishop was nearly at the elevator that he remembered the distance between the ladder and trapdoor, which surprised and disturbed him. The memory lapse was a phenomenon of organic brains. It rarely occurred in artificial persons while they were active, although it wasn't impossible. Perhaps it was a glitch caused by the loss of artificial hemoglobin. He hadn't lost enough to affect the functioning of his central nervous system, so his cognition shouldn't have been impaired, but brains could be tricky, even the artificial kind. Under normal circumstances, he'd have set a diagnostic to run continuously in the background. As things were, however, he couldn't afford to use onboard resources for anything other than the immediate situation. As he got closer to the bottom of the elevator, he saw the section of floor closest to the doors was badly cracked and broken. The alien queen had been trying to punch another hole in the floor, then stopped, probably to go after easier prey. It wasn't hard to finish what the queen had started. As soon as he pulled at the damaged floor, it came away in chunks. Another argument for luck, he thought, as he squeezed through the gap to clamber up into the mall. For a few seconds, he lay quietly with his cheek against the floor to catch vibrations from anything large and dangerous moving around nearby, but there was nothing. Even the artificial waterfall had finally shut down. It wouldn't stay this quiet, but for the moment he could hunt undisturbed through the detritus for something he could use to improve his mobility. His gaze fell on a long strip of metal on the floor, part of the frame around the elevator doors, and he picked it up. The alloy was light but very strong. Not strong enough to withstand an enraged alien, but strong enough for an artificial person with a bum leg. Working with it took longer than usual. He could feel the strain in the artificial muscles in his arms, shoulders, and upper back. He'd lost nanos along with hemoglobin, and the remaining quantity couldn't fortify or repair overworked tissue as quickly as usual. Couldn't be helped. Time was growing short, and he had furlongs to go before anyone could sleep. Not as graceful as Frost's original, he knew, but it was humans who had a way with words, not artificial persons. Hicks felt the only thing he'd ever done was slog through smoky passageways, wheezing and coughing as he and Talisa half-dragged Tatsumi between them. Spence and Jackson led the way, also wheezing and coughing, with Rossetti stumbling along at the rear, all of them heading toward a destination that Hicks wasn't sure existed anymore. Rossetti was having a harder time than the rest of them. The painkillers depressed his breathing. Tatsumi was coughing least, his respiration even more depressed by what Hicks had given him. The sedative effect of the painkiller seemed to have overridden all the other ingredients in the good shit. Rock in the house was off the agenda. Well, medication was tricky. As Dietrich had often said, injuries never read the instructions on the container. Hicks had given Tatsumi something formulated for an active, physically fit Marine badly injured in combat. It had not been made for a middle-aged scientist whose natural habitat was a laboratory, where he did a lot of strenuous thinking. Hicks imagined Tatsumi was tripping comets, but at least he wasn't in pain. After a bit, he noticed Talisa kept glancing behind them. At first, he thought she was keeping track of Rossetti, then realized she wasn't actually looking at him. "Hey," he said, keeping his voice low, "something I should know about."
"I'm afraid we're leaving a trail."
She jerked her chin at Tatsumi's leg.
"Not breadcrumbs."
Hicks saw she was right. Something thick and yellowish was leaking from the dressing on Tatsumi's wound, which, in his experience, was never a good sign. He was about to call a break so he could see how bad Tatsumi's leg was when Jackson suddenly stopped short and pointed Rossetti's pulse rifle at a shiny sign on the wall to their right. "Lifeboat Bay, 20 meters.
"See that? We made it,"
she said with a faint laugh that became a coughing fit.
"Damn." Hicks blinked at the sign. "You're right. We did."
"Don't sound so surprised," she said, and coughed some more.
"Have I ever steered you wrong?"
"The day is young."
Hicks wiped his stinging eyes, noting absently that he'd been doing that for quite some time.
"Not as young as it used to be," Jackson said,
and the grim note in her voice gave Hicks a sudden chill. Hudson smirked at him in his mind's eye.
"Goose didn't just walk over your grave, son," he said. "Goose walked over everybody's grave."
Hicks shut him down as Jackson took them around a corner into a large circular area with a reception desk. The entrance to the lifeboat bay was to the left, but the door itself was featureless. A large sign on the front of the desk declared, Lifeboat and launch assembly point, check-in, headcount, allocation. Hicks felt surreal. The reception desk made boarding a lifeboat seem as mundane as a dental appointment or a job interview. Go in when they call your number, proceed directly to your assigned bay, and don't forget to fill out the customer satisfaction survey. Thank you for your cooperation. Bon voyage, and have a nice life. Next. I thought we were meeting groups from other areas of Anchor Point, Spence said, concern large on her face. It can't be just us. Where is everyone?
Probably launched already, Hicks said, hoping he didn't sound as uneasy as he felt.
Guess again, said Jackson from behind the reception desk. She'd turned her cap around to use the light pen on the countertop screen. All lifeboats are still docked and prepped.
But that would mean we're the only ones who made it. Talisa went over to Jackson, dragging Tatsumi and Hicks with her. Could that really be it? That we're the only ones?
She looked at the others. No one said anything.
There are other lifeboat bays, Hicks said gruffly. He gave Jackson a warning look and mouthed, shut up.
Some questions had one answer, some had several, and some didn't have any. And when you only had answers nobody wanted to hear, you shut the hell up. Abruptly, Rossetti came out of his painkiller fog, went to the door and pressed his thumb to a spot at eye level. The door slid up, revealing a long hallway with soft blue indirect lighting. Hicks wondered what the hell was it with the blue lighting, as he and the others watched Rossetti march toward the very wide door at the end of the hall.
I really should have greased him, Jackson said wistfully.
Nah, Hicks said. What'd be the point?
The point? Jackson looked at him, her still grimy face incredulous. In case you forgot, the point is he let those bastards run their fucking experiments. He could have said no, but he didn't. You and Bishop tried to stop it, but not him. Rossetti let them do whatever the fuck they wanted.
No, he didn't, Hicks said, realizing he really did feel sorry for the man.
No Marine deserved to have their military career end in a state of total and absolute foobar. The only thing worse than getting wiped out with your command was being the only survivor. And the only thing worse than that was being the only survivor twice. But then, it wasn't over yet, Hicks reminded himself. There was still a strong chance he wouldn't live to regret this one.
Rossetti's rank didn't mean shit to the bastards who brought this down on Anchor Point, he went on. He was nothing but a buffer to keep the rest of us away from them. And it wouldn't do any good to grease them, either.
Bullshit, Jackson snapped. Why the fuck not? Hicks gave a short, humorless laugh.
Because what you really want to grease is the company. And I'm not sure that's even possible. As they moved down the corridor after Rossetti, he gave Talisa a questioning look. Tatsumi was getting heavier. She gave a small shrug.
Why not?
Jackson sounded slightly less belligerent.
Because Weyland Yutani's an octopus with 1,000 arms, Hicks told her. And at the end of each one is another 1,000 arms. Grease one and it'll just grow back. I doubt anyone could destroy them.
No human could, Spence piped up from behind him. But there are some non-humans I wouldn't bet against. Her words gave him another chill, more intense and apparently too real to rate a wisecrack from Hudson. He wouldn't have bet against the aliens either, Hicks thought, and they wouldn't stop at Weyland Yutani. Rossetti had reached the door and was entering a code into a small keypad on the wall beside it, or trying to. Instead of the door opening, a buzzer would sound and an electric voice would tell him to try again. It took him half a dozen tries before the door finally slid open. Hicks blinked at the brightly lit room, unaware that he and the rest of the group had stopped halfway down the hall. Rossetti had picked one hell of a big lifeboat. He could see racks and racks of vacuum suits, all immaculate white except for rings of color at the elbow and knee. Each had a matching solid color helmet. Like solid-colored billiard balls, Hicks thought, or Anchor Point's favorite brand of plastic crates. The idea dug into Hicks's brain and stuck there while he stared at the grotesque tangle of shiny black aliens amid the mess of overturned racks and crumpled vacuum suits in the center of the room. Bodies and limbs and heads protruded from the snarl at absurd angles, making it impossible for Hicks to tell how many aliens he was looking at. It was revolting, monstrous, but worst of all, unprecedented. He'd never seen them do anything like this. And still, his mind held on to the matching crates. Rossetti let out a terrified bellow and fled back up the corridor.